The Formed Book Club. Catholic book lovers unpacking good books, chapter by chapter.
Welcome to the Formed Book Club. We're pretty excited because of off-camera events, but we'll try and bring that assignment back to the on-camera here as we continue discussing The Lost Minute of Heaven by Geoffrey Shaw. We are on Chapter 1, Diplomacy in South Vietnam from the late 1950s to 1960. And as I'm reading and rereading this book, it's clear to me, you know, this is already 70 years in the past, all right? But it has incredibly important present relevance on how the United States should exercise its foreign policy in a way that really helps human flourishing in other countries. Take it away, Vivian Doudreau.
Well, if I may add on to that comment, you know, as many of you have already heard in previous book clubs, I have a son in the military, and he's also something of a historian. And he said that the major problem with American foreign policy is that Americans have a tendency to get all riled up and passionate about a situation where there may very well be an objective danger to our friends, people who would be our allies, Western interests, and all the rest. But we often underestimate what our power and projection of power can actually accomplish in these situations. And by the time we admit that to ourselves, we have done perhaps in some cases more damage and more loss of life than if we'd gone about the whole thing in a different sort of way. And rather than a military head of the spear way, conventional military. And so we keep doing this over and over and over again.
We're doing it now.
And we're doing
it today.
And we're doing it now. And so, in fact, that's how this observation of his came up, talking about current affairs. But it certainly applies to Vietnam, too. And so.
And, yes, we have had a tremendous military, that kind of military strength. But understanding the culture of the other side and also understanding their patience, they're willing to die and wait.
That's right.
And so they're just going to wait us out till we lose our patience.
That's right.
And what's happened in Vietnam, it's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's happening elsewhere.
That's right.
It's happening now. Okay, so let's go ahead.
Chapter one. So this first chapter, the author, as you like, Father, sets out immediately what he's doing. In the very first paragraph, he says he's providing the backdrop to the American betrayal of Diem. And so he begins with Diem becoming president in 1955, and how at that time, you know, the country was not in the state of chaos it ends up becoming later. But he points out in the third paragraph on the page, the communists understood the many grievances that they could exploit to organize an indigenous revolutionary movement in the South, which came to be called National Liberation Front, NLF, and the political action with the duly subordinated military campaign was needed to break the bonds being formed between the Diem government and the people, and this took the form of terrorism. And then he proceeds to outline the murders that the North Vietnamese were conducting in the South. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. They assassinated more than 400 village officials in 1959. They began murdering school teachers. And what were these? Why were they doing this? 42, second graph, second line, designed to frighten the general populace away from helping and supporting the government. A government that under Diem's leadership was determined to rebuild the villages after French rule, give them self-governments, give them livelihoods and dignity, and retain and rediscover traditional culture. And all of this was going to be undermined by this campaign of terrorism. And unfortunately, it worked.
Well, on page 44, just the table at the bottom, you know, 17 assassinations between 1950 and 60. 61, there were 1,300 in 1 year. 62, 1,700. And this was the time when, you know, Diem was now being opposed by many of this Department of State here. And what are they doing? They're rousing the people in the villages to be hostile to that government because you're killing all the good people.
And I hate to go into the details, but the footnote on page 43 I'm not going to read it out loud, but there's a direct quote there of just how gruesome these murders were, because that's what terrorists do. Yes. They do the most gruesome thing imaginable in order to frighten everybody. And that was something about this history that I knew nothing about until I read this book.
Yeah, you mentioned there that the barbaric way they killed people, disemboweling, decapitation of children, killing of pregnant women by disemboweling, etc. You weren't going to read it, I just did it. But if you go back to page 42 here, this is the actual quote from the communists, which shows that they actually proclaimed being terrorists. This is about 10 lines down on page 42. This is a quote from the National Liberation Front. Our purpose was not only to eliminate those who could be harmful to the movement, but also with a view toward making the people afraid and to prevent them from cooperating with the government. Mm-hmm. So not just a question, and this is their own words, not just a question of destroying, eliminating your enemies, but basically of terrorizing your would-be friends so that they no one is prepared to stand up to you.
That's right. And so now dealing with this kind of situation, you know, what is the government? And by the way, there were other violent groups marauding the countryside also, violent groups who were loyal to the former emperor Bao. And they were also trying to recapture power that they had lost. And so this situation, if this was going to be overcome, it was going to call for a forceful yet wise and patient approach. And that's exactly what Diem was trying to undertake. But it also meant not giving, you know, not having elections immediately and not allowing certain groups who were guilty of sedition and so on. And so this is why Diem got the reputation for being a dictator, was because he wasn't handling the opposition the way, you know, opposition gets handled.
But you think, you know, that during World War II, the British interned all those who were the members of the British Union of Fascists prior to the war. Free speech went out the window. The US government interned Japanese immigrants to the country. I mean, if once a country's on a war footing, I mean, it's one of the horrible things about war, because civil liberties get thrown out the window. But it's not as if Diem was unusual. This is what people do in the times of war. They have to put the country on a war footing with all that requires and demands.
That's right.
And of course, that leads to abuse, because you can declare martial law and then become a dictator because you want to do it. But if Jeffrey Shaw is correct, and he's vastly footnoted this thing,
yeah,
he's got all the sources. I mean, this American desire to say, you must become democratic or we won't help you.
Right.
Well, wait a minute. We've got Buddhists with you know, terror groups. We've got others in here. We got people vying for authority. We can't be democratic yet. And we'll, as we'll see, I mean, Diem's idea, and his brother knew, is that it?
Yes.
You know, was let's start with the villages and get them democratic slowly and protect them with a locally based police force that makes them feel safe and lets them flourish. And then they'll understand democracy. We can move up the scale. But no. The Americans, you know, we love democracy because it's been so good for our country. We got to say, if you're not democratic, we can't help you.
But at the same time, they told Diem, they being the Americans, not only if you're not democratic, according to our standards, can we not help you, but if you're not winning the war, we can't help you. So he was caught in this dilemma. This was a no-win situation for him. Yes,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, just saying, but as regards his initial success until this American heavy-handedness threw, as I would say, a spanner in the works, a wrench in the works, third line down on page 48, William Colby, who was CIA station chief in Saigon between 1959 and 1962, observed that given Diem's progress in stabilizing and rebuilding South Vietnam, the communists had little choice but to increase their violent attacks. Otherwise, they would lose not only the South, but potentially the North as well. In other words, this was a violent response to the fact that Diem was having success at grassroots level in the villages. And that's what was needed, is for the American to get behind that effort at grassroots, rural level. to defeat the communists rather than abandoning the field, basically.
Right. That's right. And so then we see, though, that he had not just, you know, opponents over here in America, but there was this whole group in Saigon. They came up with this manifesto. This is all spelled out on page 49.
Yes.
You know, making these demands.
The new paragraph towards the middle there. Some members of Diem's opposition put forward a manifesto of grievances, which they first announced at the Caravel Hotel in Saigon, must became known as the Caravellas. So
that's right.
We'll see what they did.
That's right. And so, you know, he was receiving, and then these were the very people talking to the reporters at the New York Times, right? So, and we're going to see more how this drama keeps heating up.
But then again, ironically, the nature of the beast that Diem is fighting, and you got these caravelists, you know, wanting niceties, but look at the nastiness of the communists on page 53 here.
Yes,
middle of that full paragraph. In 1956, there was a massive rebellion, you know, by the peasants, basically, against Ho Chi Minh's land reform, which was, in effect, Stalinist collectivization. So the state takes over the control of agriculture. Ho sent in the army, with the result that approximately 10,000 Vietnamese peasants lost their lives. Some estimate that at least 50,000 were murdered. So the ordinary small peasants living in the villages who own little property, but they do own property, were willing to rise up against communist efforts to take away the little property they have and put it in the hands of the government, which is effectively what Stalinism is and does. So this is what Diem's actually up against, and why the Americans could not see that this was the enemy that needed to be fought, and we needed to get behind the person most effectively fighting them.
That's right. And, you know, all the while that this is going on in North Vietnam, you won't find that in the New York Times, but no. You will find criticisms of Diem's land reform because supposedly the parcels aren't the right size and this and that, you know? And so the comparison was so unbelievably unfair and unjust. It's
so now
shocking.
We might stand back and go, well, we have hindsight now, 70 years.
Yes.
Okay, 60 years, 70 years. But as we'll see in this book, there are others here who had foresight, who actually saw this coming and made the point. And I think what we should be thinking about as we go forward in this book is, what was it that prevented these wise counsels that were given by Nolting and others, you know, and Colby? What was it that prevented them from being acted upon by the government? Because we're seeing the same thing today.
Yes.
The same thing.
I wonder, this is probably not justified, I'm just thinking out loud, but I do wonder whether, you know, the liberal ascendancy in the late 1950s, you know, just from the cusp of the threshold of the 60s, was also offended by the fact that Diem was a Catholic, was a devout Catholic, because quite clearly, you know, there was an anti-Christian agenda as part of this liberal secularism, which was in the ascendant, you know, in the late 50s and the 60s. And maybe one of the reasons that he was despised was because he was perceived as a radical Orthodox Christian believer.
Well, and the irony, though, is that once Kennedy was elected as the first Catholic president, he had to be concerned that people thought he was favoring his own religion.
And that's
so,
right.
And so prior to Kennedy, they were opposed him because he was Catholic. With Kennedy, Kennedy didn't want to support him because it would look like favoritism. I mean, what a bind the man was in.
Yep, that's right. That's right. But part of, to answer your question, Father, like, why were these other voices not heeded? And we get a little bit of a hint on page 54, where Shaw points out the conflict between the Department of State and the Department of the Defense, yeah. And they each having their own way of looking at it. And in a way, both of them were wrong, because the military wanted to fight a conventional war. They just, remember, we had just fought in Korea, and through a stalemate ended up, you know, ceding the North to communism and the South. And my gosh, the situation in Korea, I was just reading a description of this because of that book that we did, that man who, Thomas, help me out. The man who went to South Korea right after the Korean War.
Oh, Aloysius Schwartz.
Father Aloysius Schwartz.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the description of South Korea at this very time of, you know, most women prostituting themselves, most people involved in petty crime, most people starving, malnourished children, orphans. I mean, it was unbelievable what war had done on the Korean Peninsula. And
yet that was the only war we knew how to fight.
Exactly, because that was definitely a conventional war with tanks and all these things. And we were up against the Chinese army and the Soviet backing. And, well, the same group of Axis powers, if you want to call them, have now shifted to Vietnam. But their tactics have changed completely. This is now a guerrilla war. This is an insurgency war. And the tactics of the military hadn't caught up. And then the State Department, well, they've got their own issues with wanting to force the democracy and yada, yada, yada. So,
well, that new paragraph in the middle of page 54, the conflict that arose between Saigon and Washington, Colby recalled, was between Diem and the Department of State. The disagreement was over the direction he and the U.S. military were taking. For the DOS, Department of State, the solution was for Diem to make his regime more democratic and less authoritarian. We're in a war.
Yep. That's right. And they used the Department of State viewed U.S. military aid as leverage to pressure Diem to reform his government. So they're holding it out as a carrot. But I
can understand that. It's just say, look, we're paying for this. We're risking our lives for this. I mean, you got to listen to us because we're bigger than you. We're smarter than you. And we have more experience than you. So we'll help you, but you got to do it our way. And I can understand there's a motivation,
yes,
know, and justification for that.
Yes. But there's a really insightful quote on the bottom of 55 where Colby, who is a CIA man, and Thompson, who's the British counterinsurgency expert. Okay, Colby agreed with Thompson that a government could win over its people without being a Western-style democracy, an authoritarian government that applied the rule of law equally to all while engaging in constructive and progressive national policies, as Diem was doing, could garner popular support. And I think the key thing that isn't said there is, if you're providing these people security, now think back to what we started this session with. These villagers are being murdered. Their leadership are being murdered. Their school teachers being murdered. There's a terror campaign in the countryside. The very first thing you're going to have to do to win those people over to your side,
protect them.
Is protect them.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, in society, wherever in the world, any environment where crime's on the increase, people want stronger policing.
That's right.
It's as simple as that. So once you lose the rule of law, you have a choice between anarchy or the exercise of authority. And in a situation here in Vietnam in the late 1950s, early 1960s, we have a situation on the ground of anarchy, and people would actually welcome some authority that will put an end to the anarchy. Of course, you don't want authoritarianism as a permanent solution, but it sometimes is a temporarily necessary solution to anarchy on the ground.
That's right. And on the bottom of page 53, it says, once the Strategic Hamlet Program, and we're going to read more about that later, the Strategic Hamlet Program was in place, village elections were reinstated by the government of Vietnam because the protected peasant communities were no longer subject to communist intimidation. And this Hamlet Program was the brainchild of this Thompson, who had successfully overseen the counterinsurgency program in Malaysia. So they knew first you have to secure these places, not with, by the way, not conventional military, but with strengthened police forces,
local
police forces
who knew the people
and so on. Once you provide the security and then now you rebuild up the agriculture and rebuild the village, now the village can elect their own village leaders.
And without that, if the communists are in a position to intimidate, nobody who's an anti-communist will be able to stand in the election without fear of being killed.
That's right.
So you're going to have basically a one government. The only people that will be able to stand and not be killed will be communist candidates. So, you know, you obviously have to sort these issues out on the ground before you can have elections.
That's right.
And, of course, what are the communists? You know, they're not stupid, the communists.
No.
For sure. In fact, he makes a good point that they should have compared Diem with Ho Chi Minh.
Yes.
Who also was intelligent, and this general Jap, you know, and that's who he was fighting against, and he had to take certain means in order to be successful. Because what are the Viet Cong doing in Vietnamese? What they're saying, oh, you are all your problems are because your government is subservient to the United States. You have a puppet leader there.
That's right.
You know, so to the extent that the Diem acceded to these requests of the United States and Western powers, he was a target for the communist propaganda.
That's right.
This is, boy.
He was really in a no-win situation. Now, this was, so we probably sufficiently covered the backdrop. Do we want to move on to Ambassador Dubrow? What's our time?
Well, we're pretty close. There's a couple more things I'd like to go kind of summarize.
Okay, sure.
Page 50, about 10 lines down. This has to do with the Caravalis, the opposition that has manifesto from the hotel. We've said this before, but it kind of sums it up here. Their cry for freedom and democracy made a great play in liberal U.S. press, however, which in turn put U.S. Ambassador to South Vietnam, Elders Dubrow, we'll see about next chapter, in conflict with Diem. Essentially, under pressure from Washington, Dubrow argued that democratic reform had to flow rapidly, or the supposed proverbial dam of South Vietnamese political outrage would burst. So he's thinking if you don't become democratic right away, that you're going to have opposition from your own people. Diem countered that in any fledgling government representing an emerging nation, authority had to be maintained while democratic institutions were being constructed. This is especially the case in South Vietnam, where not just communist insurgents were hard at work undermining lawful authority, but several sects of private armies have been attempting to do the same thing. Now, we've mentioned all this, but that's it in kind of one little paragraph.
That's there. Right. That is it in a nutshell.
Then on, let's see, page 52, up from the bottom there. Why not forget that? And then I mentioned this on page 53, new paragraph. What was lacking in so much Western criticism of Diem was any fair comparison between his leadership and that of his rival in the North, Ho Chi Minh.
That's right. And then Joseph read some of those details from that paragraph. That's right.
Right. We don't have enough time to do chapter two, so why don't we
just break for now?
Call it a day, yeah. Or a night, or whatever it is, whatever time it is you're listening or watching. So next time we'll start on page 57, chapter two, U.S. Ambassador Elbridge, I say Dubrow, I don't know, Dubrow,
sure.
Okay. And we got these names, Vietnamese names, now I can't pronounce even the American names. All right. God bless you all. See you next week.
If you enjoyed this discussion, please help spread the word about the Forum Book Club by subscribing to the podcast and writing a review. You can sign up for weekly updates at formedbookclub.ignatius.com.